From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. On Saturday, the Mormon Church announced it was changing the age requirements for its missionaries. Men can now leave at age 18 instead of 19, and women at age 19 instead of 21. It's a major change, and one church officials embraced with enthusiasm, as demonstrated by Church Apostle Jeffrey R. Holland during a press conference at church headquarters.
I'm bordering on the giddy here with this announcement this morning.
The announcement has many in the faith analyzing just what the policy shift will mean for the numbers of missionaries, for marriage patterns, for college admissions, and for the role of women in the church. Today on the program, we're exploring the implications of the new Mormon mission age policy. Plus, how to succeed in small business. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Over the weekend, Mormon church leaders made a major change in policy, lowering the age requirement for young members wanting to serve a religious mission. LDS men will now serve at age 18 instead of 19, and women can serve at age 19 instead of 21. The announcement caught many faithful by surprise and set off a firestorm of conversations about just how the new policy will affect missionary demographics, marriage patterns, and the role of women in the faith. Today on the program, we're working through the repercussions of lowering the age of missionary service for Mormons and for Utah's broader culture. Joining me in studio is Catherine Jepson. She is an adjunct instructor in the sociology department at Brigham Young University, and she's working on a PhD in sociology and demography at Penn State. Her blog post, LDS Church Change and Missionary Age May Promote Equality Between Men, Mormon Men and Women, appeared in the Washington Post, and Catherine Jepson joins me in studio. Catherine, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Also with us, Jana Reese. She is the author, co-author, or editor of 9 books, including Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor, and Mormonism for Dummies. She has a PhD in American Religious History from Columbia University, and she's blogged for BeliefNet and Religion News Service. She joins us by phone from her home in Cincinnati. Jana Reese, good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
And also joining us, Bradley Kramer. He's a regular contributor to the LDS blog bycommonconsent.com. He has a master's in American history from the University of Utah. He's currently a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of Michigan, where he studies ritual language, secrecy, gender, and kinship in Mormonism. And he joins us from the studios of Michigan Public Radio in Ann Arbor. Bradley Kramer, good morning to you as well.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Later on in the program, we'll turn to small business and what it takes to succeed in a world of chain store competition and tight budgets. But first, Mormon missionaries. What are your thoughts on the age change? Will the policy affect you or someone in your family? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We'll get to all the specifics as we go, but I'm very curious about your initial reactions to the announcement. Let's start with you, Catherine Jepson.
Well, I was really excited about this announcement. I served a mission myself, and I would have loved to have gone earlier. It would have changed a lot of things in my life. And I think that being able to serve close to the same time as the young men would have kind of sent a message to me that my service was valued in a similar way. So I was really excited about the message, but I also started to think about all the things that still need to be done. So I think that this is a great move toward helping young men and women, like I said, feel that their service is equally recognized, but there's still a difference in the ages and there's still a difference in the amount of time that they can serve. So I think this is a great change. I think that the potential for increased gender equality is there, even if it was an unintended consequence of that policy change. But I think that there's a lot more room.
Mm-hmm. Brad Kramer, what are your thoughts?
As far as my initial reaction, it's interesting. There were rumors circulating that some kind of major announcement was going to happen this conference. And for the most part, those rumors weren't taken very seriously. That happened before. And there was this the consensus seemed to be that if there was genuinely something coming, then there wouldn't be rumors about it, that it would just happen. So in some sense, I came into conference with almost a heightened expectation that there would be nothing new. But when President Monson started talking about the change in age, he led with the change in age and some of the reasons for the change in age for young men. And that seemed fairly significant. I knew that they had been tinkering with this in parts of the world where university schedules or military conscription had made it more desirable for some young men to try to start serving when they were 18. So I knew that this was kind of a thing already, and it sounded to me like they were just sort of universalizing. And I thought, oh, this is a pretty big deal. And then when he switched over to young women and a more sort of radical change for young women, my reaction was much deeper, was much more significant. It felt like a much huger deal to me. And one of the things that I remember noticing was the reaction of the audience, of the church members who were in the conference center. I've never heard gasps like that. The change with the boys seemed like, yeah, this is pretty significant. The change with the girls, for maybe even for reasons that I can't quite wrap my own head around, seemed even right in the moment, just like before I had any time to kind of start to think through the repercussions, felt like just a huge deal.
Hmm. Jana Reese, what's the motivation, do you think, behind this move, and why now?
Well, I think that the motivation is all hands on deck. You know, the church is looking to expand its missionary programs, and it recognizes that it has just a wonderful proselytizing force at the ready, and that lowering the age for both men and women can bring results around the world, not only in gaining new converts, but also in retention of converts that the LDS Church has already gained. Retention has been a major issue. And so that, I think, is the major motivating factor. As far as timing, I really couldn't speculate. Certainly, I think people in the blogosphere have been talking about the coincidence of this happening right during this Mormon moment when a lot of attention is focused on the LDS Church. I really don't know. I'm sure that this was in the works for quite a while, honestly, that this was not a hasty decision.
Speaking with Jana Reese, she's the author of many books, including Flunking Sainthood and Mormonism for Dummies. She's joining us from Cincinnati. Also with us, Bradley Kramer, a regular contributor to the LDS blog By Common Consent, and Catherine Jepson, an adjunct instructor in the sociology department at BYU. We're sort of sorting out what this announcement by LDS church leaders in lowering the age requirements for young men and young women in the church to serve missions. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Brad Kramer, I mean, you mentioned that there were gasps in the audience when the changes for women came up. That seemed much more significant to you. I mean, what sort of message do you think this sends to women in the church and the place of women in church service?
Well, I'd answer that in part by way of just some sort of anecdotal information. Conversations immediately began with, you know, within the LDS blogosphere and in the Mormon intellectual community about this. And I talked with a number of women who are currently serve in their young women's programs, or in the young women's presidencies, or advisors to young women, and they all describe this as having a very sort of momentous effect on their girls, for girls within a certain age group or age demographic. This was a huge deal, and I think it's a huge deal in part because it does send a message that that we no longer consider the tension between sort of female missionary service and marriageability is being reduced. That there isn't an anxiety about women not being married as quickly as they can if they serve missions, and so the mission no longer seems like something that's sort of a second option if you haven't been married, haven't managed to get married by the time that you're 21. And the message that that, to me, the message that that sends, I mean, admittedly, I'm coming from a male perspective, but I imagine the message that it sends is that the mission is now, a part of what you should be spiritually striving for, what you're preparing for. It's a benchmark in your own spiritual progress as a young woman that now comes prior to marriage. If it's something that you want, it's something that that you don't have to sort of put off marriage an extra couple of years for in order to be able to do. You make it a priority. I think preparation for missionary service is going to be foregrounded much more in the young women's program and the curriculum. And I think just in general, it's going to increase the number of young women who serve missions dramatically. And I think that it'll change the image of Mormon missionary from a predominantly male sort of masculine. I think the message is huge, and I think that we're going to start to see the consequences of it fairly soon.
Catherine Jepson, you mentioned that you served a mission, that this change would have, if it had occurred several years ago, you would have gone earlier as a missionary. Do you think that this does send a message that more women are expected? There's an expectation of missionary service within the church? Or, what are your thoughts on the role of women in the church in light of this announcement?
I think that the church leaders have still been really clear that this isn't an expectation in a way that it is for the young men, that women don't have the same responsibility to serve missions. But I think, like Brad was saying, this is something that's going to reduce that tension between options that women have as they're starting out their adult lives. And that is something that they can prepare for earlier. And so they're going to be more directed, hopefully, in young women programs toward being spiritually prepared and becoming knowledgeable about their faith so that they would be able to share that with other people, not just seeing that as a second option in case the marriage thing falls through or in case they don't start their families as early as maybe they feel they're expected to.
Culturally, do you think that the pressures to marry young will continue in the Mormon faith, in Mormon communities?
I hope not. I hope that this is seen as a really great preparation step, in addition to getting as much education as they can before that they start those families. So I hope that this will kind of introduce a maybe not an expectation from the church leadership, but an expectation that getting married early isn't all that women are expected to do.
Jana Reese, men can now go at age 18, women at age 19. Why the age discrepancy there? I mean, why do you think church leaders decided to keep the ages different instead of both men and women serving at age 18?
I do wish that both men and women would be serving at the same age. You know, I wasn't watching General Conference on Saturday. I was attending another conference, and I was following General Conference on Twitter. The first thing that I saw was this announcement that sister missionaries would now serve at age 19. And I stared at that for a moment, and then I started to cry. I was overjoyed. And that lasted for several minutes until I kept scrolling down further into the Twitter feed, into the past, and saw that men would now be serving at age 18. And, it was like, gosh, you know, I thought for a moment that we were going to have age equality, and it didn't turn out that way. So even though it's a joyful thing, and I am very excited about this change, I agree with Catherine that this has a lot of promise for the future of Mormon women and for the entire LDS church. But there's that little twinge of sadness. I really wish that we could send the message that men and women are going to serve at the same age and for the same length of time.
Let's talk about that length of time thing. Men will serve, continue to serve for 2 years, women for a year and a half. I mean, what's the significance of that difference to you, that inequality in the length of service? Jana Reese?
Well, you know, when pressed on this issue and specifically asked that question, Elder Holland said one miracle at a time. And to me, that says this is under discussion. No doors have been closed. And the church is proceeding apace, proceeding perhaps more cautiously than some of us would like to see. But hey, I can live with that. I'm happy this is happening, and I think that things are moving forward.
We're talking about the decision by LDS church leaders to lower the age requirement for Mormon missionaries. The new policy lowering the age for both men and women. What are the repercussions for Mormon culture and for Mormon practice? If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Catherine Jepson is an adjunct instructor in the sociology department at Brigham Young University. Jana Reese is an author and a blogger. Her recent blog experience on this issue can be found in Religion News Service. Also, Bradley Kramer, a regular contributor to the LDS blog By Common Consent. And again, you can join our conversation if you like. What are you thinking about the new policy? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Mormon youth can now serve missions at a younger age thanks to a policy shift made public last weekend. It's a change that brought tears of joy from some and left others speculating about the ripple effects for college admissions, life plans, marriage trends, and missionary demographics. We are talking about the new policy with Catherine Jepson, an adjunct instructor in the sociology department at Brigham Young University. Also with us, Jana Reese, an author and a blogger, and Bradley Kramer, another contributor to the LDS blog By Common Consent. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on lowering the age requirements for Mormon missionaries? Will more Mormon youth serve a mission? How do you think the policy will affect Mormon culture and Utah culture specifically? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. The age issue, I would imagine, has been a question mark for many Mormon kids who are college bound. Bradley Kramer, what will the college experience look like on church-owned campuses like BYU? I mean, if a freshman woman enters at 18, there may be very few of her male counterparts on campus, I'm imagining.
Yeah, I mean, that's already that sort of demographic disparity already exists to some extent on BYU's campus. And I think it's worth mentioning or worth noting that because most high school students turn 18 during their high school year, during the actual school year, and because there's a policy in place that even for the young men, they have to finish high school before they can go, the practical outcome of this is that there will most men who choose to go as soon as possible, I mean, the average age will probably be at least 18 and a half. And young women who choose to go as quickly as possible could still be going very shortly after they finish high school. They're going to be returning home at roughly the same, average age, 20.5 years probably. And so the post-mission age demographics are going to be basically balanced. I don't imagine that you're going to see very many, that you're going to see a huge change in terms of, freshman year demographics. I think that the bigger change will probably affect things like athletics, redshirting freshmen, things like that. But for the most part, I don't see there being a sort of dramatic shift in the demographic breakdown of the freshman class at, say, Brigham Young University.
Catherine, you're on campus at BYU. I mean, are you kind of bracing yourself for a different profile in your classes or not so much?
Well, I teach upper division classes generally, and so I think that once they get to me, the age distribution, the experience is probably going to be about the same. But I do worry that not as many women will complete college, not as many women will have that opportunity. I think that right now, often women have kind of a chance to get ahead while men are on missions. And as they're not serving as often, they might finish college by the time men come home or be close to finishing. And then we see a lot of examples of women working after college to until their husbands finish college. And I worry that I like the idea of men and women being at about the same age when they return home from their missions and kind of being on equal footing as far as their spiritual experiences and their mission, the things that their mission has given them. But I do worry that that will mean that there aren't as many women finishing college on LDS campuses.
Janarisa, Brad mentioned the implications for the athletic programs at many colleges, and there's been locally some reporting on, you know, just how recruiters are strategizing on how to deal with the changes. I mean, any thoughts on that, Janarisa?
Wow, you are so asking the wrong person about athletics. Can I just say, geek with geek cred here, I am the most uncoordinated person ever. I would say this is not about athletics, but just about all of the changes that happen during that collegiate experience. There was a great article yesterday in the Deseret News by a woman who, as a young woman, had dreamed of going on a mission. And she was with this whole cohort of other women at BYU that she was rooming with. There were 12 of them, and they basically all wanted to go on a mission. But by the time they were 21 and 22, actually only one of them went on to serve. So how does that happen? You know, how does it happen that you have these women who are very passionate, very devout when they're 19, and then 2 years later, which is not that long of a time, but so much happens, you know, life has kind of gotten in the way. Some of them are going on, moving on with their careers. Some of them are getting married and having families. Some of them might have been disaffected with religion, which is something we haven't talked about. And I think that the new lower missionary age for both genders addresses a larger trend in American culture, which is that we have more young people leaving organized religion, not just Mormonism, but organized religion in general, than we have since the 18th century in American history, right? So this is a way of keeping people in the fold at a very crucial time.
I mean, do you think that church leaders are really wrestling with that question? How do we keep our young members lifelong members?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think that is number one on the agenda at many meetings, definitely.
Brad?
Oh, yeah, I strongly agree with Jana here. I think the church leaders, the part of what's happening here is church leaders looking at this sort of this demographic trend, this problem, this hemorrhaging of membership in LDS young adults, and seeing this period of lag between finishing high school, graduating from seminary, sort of entering into early adulthood, and the mission experience as being a time when a lot of young Mormons are leaving the church. And so the effort to close that gap, I think is at least partly motivated by the desire to sort of bridge some continuity there in terms of being involved in things that really strongly reinforce your commitment to Mormonism, your investment in, you know, the success of Mormonism. So I think it's definitely a part of the equation.
We're talking about the Mormon age requirement policy shift, allowing younger Mormons to go on missions. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Heidi joins us from Salt Lake City. Heidi, hello.
Hi. I was just calling. I serve as a young woman president. I've searched for a while, and I just wanted to say that the young women I serve with have been overjoyed by this news. And two of them have gone on to college, and they've all said that this was an answer to their prayers because they wanted to serve, but now they can go. Well, they can go now because they're both 20. But I was also wondering if maybe this would help people get married younger, because now they'll get home from their missions younger and possibly get married younger also.
Interesting question, Heidi. Thanks so much for the call. Catherine, you're the sociologist. What do you think? I mean, Mormon women traditionally have been encouraged to marry young and to start a family in their 20s. So are people going to be encouraged to marry even younger?
My guess is that the change in the ages can kind of have two effects. One that Brad mentioned, with having the losing fewer young men in between that high school and mission time. And then two, having the men be more prepared earlier for life, for college. So I think that the emphasis on marrying early and marrying soon and not postponing families is going to remain constant from the church leaders. I think that this change can help make it easier for people to do that. I think that by making a bigger pool, because we hopefully won't be losing as many people in between high school and a mission, by making a bigger pool of people available for young women to marry can help increase the marriage rates still at that earlier age than the national average.
Mm-hmm. Jana Reese, thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that. I think that the concern, though, is probably for both men and women, that everyone would be remaining in the fold in this very crucible time of development and growth spiritually. I just called up the Pew survey. The other big religion news this week was that the Pew Foundation released its survey of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. And the number of millennials, so this age group between 21 and 30, who have no religious affiliation is up to 32%. 32% who say they have no religious affiliation, which is higher than it's ever been. And we're now up to basically 20% in the overall population. So this is a concern for religion across the board.
Brad Kramer, to Heidi's question, do you think marriage will happen sooner?
I'm not sure that it'll happen sooner, and I'm not sure that that's the most important sort of question to be asking about what this does for marriage in Mormonism necessarily. I think maybe the deeper question is what it does in terms of prioritizing. I think for a long time you've had this very interesting phenomenon. A friend of mine pointed this out recently, that if you with Mormon youth, they go through the young men's and young women's program, and they're taught all kinds of principles and values, and you know they're taught to they're taught something that is believed to be vital about Mormonism. The young men are taught that this is going to help you prepare to be a missionary, and young women are taught this is going to help you prepare to go to the temple, which is basically euphemism for prepare to be married. But now, what's going to happen, what's much more likely to happen, is that young women are going to get the message, either overtly or even just implicitly, that they're being taught what they're being taught in part to prepare them to be missionaries, to be missionaries before they get married. And with the idea that the mission experience will help them, prepare them to more effectively serve in the church. In other words, it's no longer it sort of takes a lot away from the idea that their primary goal in life is just is their own marriageability, and that their own spirituality is so bound up with their marriageability. So what I suspect, that to the extent that that message gets taken up, that they are valued independently of their marriageability, and that they are valued because of the service that they can give first as missionaries and then owing to their missionary experience to the church throughout their lives, you know, it's hard to predict, but I suspect that will probably, one of the effects of sort of taking that message in and internalizing it will be that young Mormon women will feel less pressure at the personal level to get married as quickly as possible. They'll devote more energy to, you know, getting education and to preparing to have other measures of success in life above and beyond what I still imagine will remain an important goal to them, which is to get married and have a family. But I think it's likely to balance more.
Jana Reese, I mean, do you think the announcement is going to change what Mormon youth are taught in Sunday school fundamentally?
Absolutely. I do, because, you know, we have to recognize that this announcement came at exactly the same time that the church also rolled out its brand new curriculum for young women and young men. And if you've taken a look at that at all, it's pretty clear that they want these people to then turn around and be able to teach doctrine, not just young men, but also young women. So this is taken very seriously. It's not that I was about to make a snide comment about, you know, all of us sitting around and making crafts. I actually love crafts, and crafts are great. But the idea of the Young Women's Program is that we are raising women to be servants of God, and that that is what is going to be emphasized week in and week out. And isn't that awesome?
It's a huge deal.
What are you hearing in the blogosphere, Brad? I mean, are people generally embracing the change?
It's interesting. There's been a lot of talk in the blogosphere, especially in the more, progressive or feminist corners of the blogosphere, a lot of talk about practical change. This is another thing that struck me a lot. I'm close friends with several women who have really gone to great lengths to try to publicly push for and promote sort of practical changes that benefit women in the church. And one of the most telling things that I heard recently was one of these women was talking to me and saying, In all of the years that I have been trying to think about the kinds of practical changes that we could have, it never occurred to me that lowering the missionary age for girls would be an important one. It was never high on my priority list. I didn't think much about it. It was only once the change happened that it started to become clear to this woman how huge it is, and it may be, in retrospect, the single biggest thing that the church, sort of realistic, practical change that the church could have made, in moving in a direction of more equity and parity between men and women at all levels of the church.
Catherine, you served a mission when you were 21. I'm interested in your take on maturity. I mean, are 18-year-old boys mature enough to handle the day-to-day pressures that missionaries have to deal with? Are 19-year-old women ready in a mature sense?
I think they are. I think there are 19-year-old men that weren't mature enough. There were 21-year-old women that weren't mature enough. But I think in general, people can rise up to the things that are asked for, especially if they're prepared and if they have leaders who are supportive and who give them the information and the guidance and the training that they need. I think it's great that men and women will be doing this before college, because I think I've heard arguments that it's better for example, for men to have a year of college so that they're more prepared for a mission. But I think that a mission can be a great thing to prepare people for college and, as Brad was saying, for future service in the church. But I do think this also, it does send a different message too, that the service of women is a little bit qualified because of that age difference we were mentioning before and because of the time length. I think that, yes, this serves sends a message that women can internalize that their service is welcome and valued, but I think that there's still this very strong distinction between the service from men and from women, and especially if we don't see changes in who can serve in leadership positions in those missions, it will just keep these differences reinforced and internalized, and they'll just get reproduced through the rest of those women's lives and in the other structures of the church.
Jana,
well, the biggest difference isn't the age difference, I think. I think the age difference is a manifestation, is a sort of consequence, a practical consequence of the biggest difference. The biggest difference is that it's a requirement, it's an obligation for boys, and it's an option for girls. And that's, I think, the biggest disparity and the thing that most needs correcting in the long run. But I think, nevertheless, I think the practical consequence of this is still going to be a huge surge in the number of women who choose to serve, whether or not they feel like they're doing it out of an obligation. I think that you're just going to see a huge shift.
Our time is short, but Jana Reese, you mentioned that you were elated and then that was tempered when more came out about this policy change. And I guess I'm just wondering, what would you like to see as a next step for church leaders? And do you think that change is going to be ushered in quickly or take another decade?
I hope it doesn't take a decade. I think what I would love to see is all missionaries serving for 2 years, except for senior missionaries who may have other life circumstances, but all younger missionaries serving for 2 years. I would like to see all younger missionaries having the option to go at age 18, which, as Brad has said, is, you know, it's kind of 18 and a half to 19 maybe already. So perhaps this is just a semantic difference. I think it's a little more than that. And the third thing is what Catherine has already alluded to, which is having women serve in leadership positions. One of the interesting things I've seen this week is people talking online about individual mission presidents who have made young women, sister missionaries, made them zone leaders, given them a lot more responsibility, and they have completely risen to the occasion, and so have the young men in following their lead. So we have precedent for this. We have people willing to serve. Let's go for it.
Do you think that the policy change, I guess finally, for do you think the mission experience will be fundamentally different because of these changes? Brad, I'll start with you.
I think it will. I think the missionary experience will be different because of the, just the sheer demographic change. I mean, you sisters missionaries in my mission felt like an important but token presence. It was sort of a, it was a gift if you got to have. On the one hand, it was a gift if you had sisters in your district, because there was a sense that there was a certain maturity there. That they, I mean, they sort of half-jokingly talked about the sisters keeping the elders in line, but also that they were very successful. The flip side to that was that there was also a kind of sense that the presence of sisters disrupted a little bit of sort of male fraternity in the district. And in the long run, I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think the mission right now is still a predominantly male experience. It's conceived in terms of priesthood responsibility and preparation for future service in the church. And if we get to a point 10 years from now where women constitute 40% of the mission force, it's going to feel different. It's going to be different. It's going to be less predominantly male. And it's going to, but I suspect it will still be understood in part in terms of preparation for future service in the church and future service in the church for both sexes. So, yeah, I think it really will alter the sort of the dominant images and the flavor of what the mission is like.
And Catherine, I guess I'll give you the last word, 30 seconds. I mean, do you think the mission experience will be just very different from what you experienced as a missionary?
I do. In my mission, too, there were fewer sisters. I think about 20% of the missionaries were sisters, and it was very much a token category, a token experience. I think that having more sister missionaries serving alongside the young men missionaries can help men and women to be able to relate to them to each other more as peers, and it may help these young adult men see sisters as peers, not as temptations or distractions, but as people who can contribute equally and have the same desire to serve.
Catherine Jepson, she's an adjunct instructor in the sociology department at Brigham Young University. Catherine, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Jana Reese, author of Flunking Sainthood and Mormonism for Dummies, and you can find her blogs at Religion News Service. Jana, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Bradley Kramer, regular contributor to the LDS blog by commonconsent.com. Brad, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And we'll have links to the pieces that these folks have written on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, tips for growing a small business. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Small businesses represent over 96% of all Utah employers, and they employ 46% of the state's private sector. But with limited staffing, tight budgets, and competition from national chains, just how can small businesses survive and thrive? Today on the program, we're talking about how small businesses can grow and succeed with Mike Bryan. He is a partner and interactive director of Penna Powers Bryan Haynes, an advertising agency based here in Salt Lake City. He's one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming first annual Small Business Summit. being held next week. We'll give you details on that as we go. But Mike Bryan, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
You can join our conversation if you've got questions about marketing a small business on limited funds. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Mike Bryan, you are speaking about branding and marketing for small business. I mean, small businesses face a number of disadvantages. As I mentioned, they're limited on funds. They have limited staffing. What do you think small businesses can do that the big businesses have a harder time at?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the nimbleness of a small business, the ability to change and adapt and move inside of a market space is pretty easy for them because they're small. It's a smaller boat to be able to shift the direction. The problem that they typically have is most of them can't have the resources to go to a big agency that's got all the experience and find out what to do. And so they kind of wing it. You know, they go out and they try this. Oh, that didn't work. Let's try this. And they try that and that didn't work. Let's try this. So they end up spending a lot of time guessing at stuff. In fact, on the back of my business card, I have a quote that says, the more you know, the less you guess. And guessing is really expensive. And it's expensive because you have to start over. You know, once you try something, it didn't work, you start over. And so what we found is when you get a business that has been able to grow and adapt and they've been successful, there's usually a pretty good bell curve of getting up to be successful. Once they get up there, they say, wow, I wish I'd have known what I know now. I could have done it in a third the time had I known what I know now. And that's a planning game. And so, you know, one of the things that I'll be talking about is get some help from just the planning perspective. Get a roadmap. Get somebody that knows, that's been there. Get some people that have gone through this and have them help you figure out a plan.
So that's the first step, is to network and to talk to people about their experiences and lessons learned along the way.
Yeah. You know, actually, the scariest part is the first thing is, does anybody but you want to buy your product? Everybody wants to buy their own product, right? What the first thing to do in a marketing strategy is find out, is this product going to bear a market at all? You got to find that out first. Then you go through the rest of the marketing steps. That's why there's a difference in the marketing and the branding. The branding is just a piece of that. The marketing part of it that we'll be talking about is you got to figure out the science of your business first, then position it and align it with your audience and your market, and then brand it.
How do you find out if there are people willing to buy, to spend money on the product that you're trying to sell?
How do you find out if they're there?
Yeah.
Okay. So as awkward as this sounds, is anybody buying anything like it? I mean, that's what you do. You look around and say, okay, you know, you got these anomalies like the Pet Rock, right? You got these anomalies where somebody found something that fit into a niche that no one knew. And we just call those anomalies. We have to take them out because they're just weird, right? Typically, what you'll find is you'll find people that come up with a product that's very similar to something else in the space. You have to go look at that and say, is that product successful that's in a parallel market? It's a different product maybe, but is that product successful in the market it's attracting like mine is? And then start to test it. Start doing some testing and see if it will take some legs.
Hmm. What if you have a brick and mortar store, a little boutique or a little market? Those are all over the place. So if, you know, somebody down the block can do it, surely I could, right?
Right. Right. Well, everybody thinks that, right? So they pop a shingle, they throw their shingle out and say, I'm ready, I'm open for business. And the counsel that we like to give small companies that do that, where they're one location, is it's kind of like an epicenter of an earthquake. You need to call your store ground zero, and your resources that you have depend on how far out you can market that. It's kind of like a ring. So what you do is you say, this is where my epicenter is. This is where my store is. I'm going to market 2 miles out, and that's my primary market. Anything else that comes in is going to be word of mouth anyway.
Hmm. How different is the advice that you give to a small business than the advice that you give to a larger company?
It's radically different, and it's radically different primarily because of the resources available. Okay, so small businesses usually can't go and get an agency to be like a retained agency where they're on strategy with them full time, because by the time an agency, a typical ad agency, can figure out what they need to do, they've burned all their resources. Then they can't make anything happen because they know what to do, but they don't have any money to make it happen.
Mm. We're speaking with Mike Bryan. He's a partner and the interactive director at Penna Powers Bryan Haynes. It's an ad agency here in Salt Lake City. He's one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming first annual Small Business Summit, which will be held next Wednesday, October 17th, at the Radisson Hotel downtown. Registration is $30, and for more information, you can find out through some links on our website, kcpw.org. But we're talking about branding and marketing for small businesses. What do you want to know? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Mike, I imagine that technology has really opened up some new avenues for the small business when it comes to marketing and branding, but it's certainly not a sure bet. I mean, just because you post something on Facebook, it's not going to catch wildfire. What advice do you have for small businesses when it comes to Facebook and Twitter and social media? What works and what doesn't?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, When the social media, which literally is just word of mouth, I mean, it's just a bigger high school, right? That's all it really is. When that thing hit the marketplace, we looked at it really closely, and it kind of scared us a little bit. And the reason it scared us is it's uncontrolled. You know, in a normal advertising and push environment, we create an advertisement running on the TV. No one can affect that because they're not in a position to really call in and argue with it. In a social media environment, someone can put something out there. In fact, we've told clients, you need to get a Facebook page because if you don't, someone else will, about your product or your business. So you need to get it, establish it, and start watching it closely. And if people will just get in the back of their mind that this is a online version of a human network, this is just an online version of it, and they need to pay that much attention to it. They literally need to be on that thing, watching it 24 hours a day, making sure that they're making sure the messaging is carrying their branding forward, instead of they're not paying attention to it, because it can slip really quickly. Someone can just take it and run the other direction if you're not really, really careful, because it's uncontrolled.
What about email? I mean, is that helpful anymore, or is that just considered spam?
Well, it kind of depends, because email has started to evolve past the gimmickry of getting something in email. People are really intimate with their email now, so they're really turning off anything that comes to them. I don't care if they even want it. They're saying, get me off your list. This is not what I use email for. Now, we have a lot of clients who will still do that, but they're cultivating. It's part of a social network, actually, because they're cultivating these lists of people say, I want your information, and I want it outside of the network. I want to get something from you direct.
How often should a small business sort of freshen up its marketing approach? I mean, once you get a strategy in place, by the time you've got those lessons learned, do you have to start over again? I mean, how often should small businesses be thinking about marketing and branding and rebranding?
Yeah. Well, you know, in our opinion, this is never done. This isn't something that you say, okay, this is getting old, let's start over. Because if you've got the indicators and the benchmarks and measurements that you're watching about your business and your branding, and small businesses can do this a lot easier because they have a smaller bucket they're trying to control. If you can watch how sales go and you can watch how the market's moving, you should be able to make subtle adjustments and never have to start over.
Let's get our callers in on the conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. Steve is calling from Salt Lake City. Steve, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I have a question. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I was wondering, how does somebody market for a product that people don't want to admit that they need? I think it's difficult to do word of mouth because people don't want to ask their friends or admit to their friends that, hey, I need a criminal defense attorney.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good question. And you've actually seen in the market where some people have gone out there, and sadly, they'll go out there on their own trying to figure this out, and they'll just start, which is the term we use a lot, winging it. And they don't understand that what they do actually will position the entire industry in a negative light. And then there's no recovery from that. In your situation, I think the strongest avenue that you have is your website. Your website is, because this is what happens. People, you're kind of out of mind unless I really need you, especially as a criminal lawyer, right? And don't get me wrong, people will need you, right? When they need you, they're going to their local network of friends to find somebody that they know, because it's a scary thing. They want to be able to cut through the relationship game quickly, so they want somebody they know. The next step is going to go online to see if you're reputable, if you've got the experience they're looking for, and you can match up with what that experience is.
Steve, thanks for the call. We've only got a few seconds left, but I mean, how much can a small business do for itself? And when do you know it's time to go out and seek somebody from Pen of Powers?
Okay. I think that a small business, if they, I mean, our benchmarks are pretty clear. We typically want to work with someone that's worked with an agency, but obviously you got to work with one at one time to get started. Once you realize that you have enough resources to attack an industry vertically, call one. Go sit down with them. Tell them what your needs are. Tell them what your market is. Tell them what your demands are. You got to tell them what your resources are. One of the mistakes people do is they come in and go, I'm not going to tell you how much money I have. Just tell me what you can do. Mm. They can't help you if you do that. You got to come in and open the book with them and say, this is how much money I have. Could you help me or not? And I'm hoping the agency will be legit and say, not yet. If you don't have enough resources, you need to do ABC. Pay for that help. Get that first step and then get to where you need to be.
Mike Bryan, a partner and interactive director of Penna Powers, Bryan Haynes, an ad agency here in Salt Lake City, one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming first annual Small Business Summit happening next Wednesday, October 17th at the Radisson Hotel downtown. You can find out more information on our website, kcpw.org. Mike, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Coming up tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.